youth have already been welcomed, and I had to think, what lovelier problem could we have than we have that many youth, we don't know where to put them. So God bless you for coming. I trust you will be blessed, encouraged, and warned, and all of us as well. Brother Vince had no idea, but the Holy Spirit did, that his devotional would be a great appetizer for the message. But before I go into the message, I have a couple questions I want to ask you, and this is unfortunately kind of for the locals. And these questions are not to trap you or to trick you, or they're simply to get you thinking. How did the face of our place here, our property, change in the last week and a day? How did it greatly change? You can tell me. Or didn't you see it? I see a few hands. No, they just don't want to raise your hands. Okay. Brandon, how did it change? Was that tree here as long as you were here? I was here as long as I was here too. The big tree came down. Now, here's the questions. How many of you were sad to see it go? Please. How many of you were glad to see it go? Well, some are conflicting answers. That's how many of you didn't even care? There's one. That's amazing. Oh, that's just interesting. I felt saddened because even though the stairwell over here won't get its bounty of leaves in that need cleaning out, and we won't have to clean the sticks out of the driveway, there's a lot went into that tree. It was a big tree and it was there for a long time. I tried to count the rings and it was kind of hard without putting a lot of time into it. And it was probably 90 or 100 years old. I don't know. But if so, that made it 30 years old when this building was built, just to give you a little idea. And I had to think back about how many times people purposely parked onto it, under it on a hot summer Sunday morning so they wouldn't come out to such a hot car. And how many times we sat under it for our fellowship meals, and after a while you moved your chair a little because you were getting in the sun and it was really hot that day. We had song services beside it. There was a few times we had instruction class underneath it. There's a big hole there. Something is missing. Well, as trustees, try to be just a little bit proactive, not near enough. We planted 3 little trees to take its place. But you know what? We're going to all be gone before those 3 trees make up for the 1 big tree. That's just the way it is. It takes a long time to grow that much shade. Turn to 1 Chronicles 29. We have a verse here that I don't know if I had never saw it or never took notice of it, but it was read at the family meeting before my father's funeral. And some comments were made about it. I'd like to read verses 26 to 30 of 1 Chronicles chapter 29. Thus David the son of Jesse reigned over all Israel, and the time that he reigned over Israel was 40 years. 7 years reigned he in Hebron, and 33 years reigned he in Jerusalem. And he died in a good old age, full of days, riches, and honor, and Solomon his son reigned in his stead. Now the acts of David the king, first and last, behold, they are written in the book of Samuel the seer, and the book of Nathan the prophet, and the book of Gad the seer, with all his reign and his might, and the times that went over him, and over Israel, and over all the kingdoms of the countries. Now the phrase that I want is found in verse 30, and it simply says, and the times that went over him. What do you think that means? That's kind of a general statement, isn't it? I looked it up in some other versions, and they thought it means this: the circumstances that surrounded him, or, and everything that happened to him, or the times through which he passed. Now, when we stop and think about it, especially if you lived more than a few years, we realize that life is full of innumerable happenings, circumstances, situations that come our way. And for each one of us, those circumstances are at least slightly different, if not greatly different, than most everybody else. So for a title, I've chosen The Times That Went Over the Oak Tree. I struggled to know what to title the message, but I thought it was timely with the parting of our oak tree. The times that went over the oak tree. Let's think for just a little bit about some of them times that went over that oak tree in the last 90 years. Now, we know that all oak trees come from acorns. Somehow, right there in that spot, a long time ago, an acorn fell or was planted, and it sprouted. Now, many acorns fall to the ground. A lot of them never grow. At home, we have a out back, we have an oak tree that's, I mean, it's a midget toward that tree. It's a nice-sized tree, but it's a midget. And in the fall, I guess, or over the winter, it drops acorns. And this fall, it dropped, it may have been thousands. It was that many, you couldn't hardly walk under that tree without stepping on acorns. It was just a lot, and I had to think, well, this is going to be a rough winter. Now, some people thought it was a rough winter. I didn't think it was. It got cold, but we didn't have a lot of snow, and we had some nice days. So I don't know what all those acorns were for. I kind of doubt that any of them are going to sprout. They tell us that actually most acorns that do sprout are planted by squirrels. I found that very interesting. And I had to think about that tree because we have it mulched around the bottom, and I'll have acorns growing in that mulch, but I don't have acorns growing in the grass around it. What squirrel would plant inside when he can plant in the mulch? Many acorns either dry out because it's too hot and dry, or else they rot because it's too wet. But this one out here, somehow, 90 years ago or so, had all it needed to sprout, and it grew right there beside our parking lot, but our parking lot wasn't even there then. Isn't that fascinating? Well, that sprout eventually grew into a sapling, but it was many years before it was large enough to park underneath, to park your car underneath for shade, and even many more years yet until we thought of sitting under it for a fellowship meal. But it continued to grow, and according to my feeble attempts at measuring it, it was probably close to 70 feet tall when we took it down, and around the base it was 9 feet around the base. It was a lot of tree. And for 90 years or so, it weathered all kinds of weather, spring, summer, fall, and winter, hot, cold, wet, and dry, and it was never brought indoors. And it was never sheltered. It just simply sat there and grew, continually exposed to the elements. They say a mature oak tree like that can use up to 100 gallons of water a day on a hot summer's day. And I have no idea how that tree survived, because I don't know where it got 100 gallons of water a day. But it continued to grow, and it continued to produce acorns and leaves, and it was a place for squirrels to hide. When we began to cut at it, 3 squirrels ran out. They have no home, I guess, or else they found another one. Now, some years ago, that tree began to have what we saw, a lot of dead branches up, and we got a high lift in here, and we went up and cut a lot of them out rather than have them fall in people's cars. And also, while we weren't watching, it developed a massive crack right down the middle. Now, if you're like me, you kind of think that oak trees live forever. And oak trees just last and last. But that's not true. Oak trees die too. And a tree with a crack down the middle is going to die from the inside out. But we didn't want to see our tree go. We wanted to keep it for the shade, and so we went up with a chain and a binder and drew them limbs together as much as we could so that it wouldn't split anymore. But finally, other branches were starting to die. It was time to bring it down. And now Brother Loyal's house will be nice and warm next winter because he got the wood. And so, as they say, the oak tree is history. And there's no way that you and I can stand here and talk about that tree and remember or even know all it went through in them 90 years. And it's true for David, too. Here in the end of this book, in the end of this chapter, in this last verse, it simply says that the times that went over him, the many, many things that made up his life, simply went over him. Now, there's a lot of things that are different between the oak tree and King David. There's probably more things different than there are similar, even though both could say a lot of times went over me. One of the biggest things I had to think of was that an oak tree does not choose what it does in varied circumstances. God has simply put into it, you grow. You draw in moisture, you use sunlight, and you grow. And that tree did that for many years. That's simply what it did. But for David, it was quite different. Circumstances came his way, and as they came to him, he had to make decisions. He had to decide what he's going to do in this situation. It's the same for us today. We have times passing over us. And as they come to us, we're going to say, oh, what do I do here? Or aren't we going to even care? We'll just say, well, we'll see what happens. But either way, we're making a decision with everything that comes our way. And someday, our history is written. And we will look back, and others will look back, and we will see the history of what we did with the times that went over us. Well, I'd like to look at some of the times and circumstances that David faced. Certainly not all that he faced, not near. And hopefully in that we can find some direction for our lives. Turn to 1 Samuel 16. Here is where we have the first mention of David as a youth. And Samuel the prophet had been called, asked by God to go meet with Jesse and his sons in the town of Bethlehem and anoint one of his sons to be king after King Saul. But God didn't tell Samuel which one it is. And we're not going into depth on that story, but just like to read verses 6 to 13 of 1 Samuel 16. They were coming now, and he was looking at the sons, trying to figure out which one to anoint. And it came to pass when they were come that he looked on Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither hath the Lord chosen this. Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by, and he said, neither hath the Lord chosen this. Again Jesse made seven of his sons to pass before Samuel, and Samuel said unto Jesse, the Lord hath not chosen these. And Samuel said unto Jesse, are these all thy children? And he said, there remaineth yet the youngest, and behold, he keepeth sheep. And Samuel said unto Jesse, send and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he come hither. And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and withal of a beautiful countenance, and goodly to look on. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. Now what can we learn in this little happening here? My first point is simply the time for dependability. We're going to talk about times or circumstances. The first point is the time for dependability. Now, we don't know David's exact age here, but one thing we do know is that it wasn't strange for him not to go along to the sacrifice. The sacrifice was said to be for the elders of the town. And David was young enough that it didn't seem strange for him not to be there. He was a youth, and it was fine if he stayed home and tended the sheep. But the other thing I see here in David at this young age was dependability. His father knew exactly where he was and what he was doing. He was keeping the sheep. He was doing the job that he had been given. And I think he was doing it faithfully. How do we know that? Well, we know it because later he could write Psalm 23, and David knew exactly what it took to be a good shepherd. And I believe he was that kind of a shepherd, a dependable one. And for some reason, I can't picture Jesse sighing as he said, behold, he keepeth the sheep, and thinking, well, that's what I told him to do, but he's probably all absorbed in his smartphone right now. Or maybe he never left the sheep out this morning because he's messing with his slingshot. He knew where he was. He's keeping the sheep. I think David was a good shepherd and a dependable one. Shortly after this, when Saul and his army was facing Goliath and David's brothers were in the army, Jesse sent David with some groceries. I did a little research, and I have no idea what the road or the trail was like that he had to take back in those days, but it was probably a 15 or 20 mile hike. And we're told that he rose early in the morning, and he got there as they were ready to go fight, which I have no idea what time that was. But there's something about getting up early and getting there in time that spoke to me again of dependability. Jesse could trust David to make that trip, make it on time, and get the goods delivered. David was dependable. And I think he wasn't only dependable, but he was also responsible. Let's go into point number two, and that is the time for responsibility. The time for responsibility. Did you notice that when Samuel anointed David to be king, we're told that the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. And I had to think of Romans 8:11, but if the Spirit of him that raised up Jesus from the dead dwell in you, he that raised up Christ from the dead shall also quicken or make alive your mortal bodies by his Spirit that dwelleth in you. You know, when the Holy Spirit indwells a person, he gives them life and purpose. And with that purpose comes responsibility. And that was David. In your Bibles, let's look right over to 1 Samuel 17. This is where David actually met Goliath. And there's no way we can read this whole thing for lack of time. Read it sometime if you haven't lately. It is a pretty amazing story. But I'd like to read, first of all, thinking about Goliath and David's response to him. I'd like to read verses 8 to 10. 1 Samuel 17, verse 8. This is Goliath. And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. If he build a fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. Now here was the challenge. And this ungodly man said, I defy the armies of Israel. Don't forget that he said that. Well, into this situation came David, a young shepherd boy, too young to be in the army, only old enough to deliver the groceries. But he heard this challenge. And in verse 26 is his response. David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? That's what David saw. That was his assessment of the situation. Now look at verse 31. And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail him because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Verse 36, thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. Verse 43, and the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the hosts of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Now let's talk about responsibility. Here are the facts. The facts were that David had only been sent to deliver some groceries, and to see how his brothers were making out. Secondly, his own brother said that, David, you have no business being here. Go back home. Not one other soldier was willing to fight Goliath. The king was afraid. The king discouraged him from trying to fight Goliath, and the giant cursed him. Those were the facts of the situation. So why did David do it? He would have had more excuses than anybody else not to do it, but he did it. Responsibility sees beyond the obvious and the easy. Responsibility sees beyond the obvious and the easy. What was the obvious? Well, it was obvious that the giant was too big for any regular soldier to beat. It was obvious that David was not a soldier. It was obvious that he had not been asked to fight. It was obvious that he was foolish to try something that not one of Saul's thousands of experienced fighters was willing to do. It was also obvious that the whole nation's freedom was hanging in the balance. None of this mattered to David. Why? Because what he had noticed, what was bigger to him than all the obvious, was that Goliath had defied the armies of the living God. To David, that was not so obvious. What was not so obvious of an observation was the main thing. Nobody else thought of that. They all saw the challenges and the problems, but David saw the main issue. He saw beyond the obvious, and he acted accordingly. Were you ever asked to make a delivery and you ended up killing a giant? Me neither. And you ended up winning a battle. But as I thought about that, I believe that if we're willing to take notice, life is filled with countless opportunities to live this principle. See, oftentimes we're too busy tending the sheep and delivering the groceries that we miss the main point of living. We don't take the responsibility to look for opportunities to make a difference in the deeper issues of life. In the time of responsibility, when responsibility was needed, David was there. May that challenge us. Number three, the time for respect. Shortly after this victory over Goliath, Saul became very jealous of David and did his best to kill him. And we know that twice David had an opportunity to kill Saul, but he refused to do it. Turn to 1 Samuel 24. We're going to look at just one of those incidents, one of those times. 1 Samuel 24. I'd like to read verses 2 to 7. 1 Samuel 24. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel, 3,000, mind you, and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where was a cave. And Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. And the men of David said unto him, Behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemies into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privately. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, The Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David stayed his servants with these words and suffered them not to rise against Saul. But Saul rose up out of the cave and went his way. Now, it would have been an extremely easy thing here for David to kill Saul. But instead, he just cut off a corner of Saul's robe as proof that he could have killed him. But even that small act bothered David's conscience. It bothered him that he gave in and did that because he felt it was disrespectful to the one that God had placed as an authority in his life. Now, we live in an age when it's extremely expected and accepted to disrespect authority. And I think we can easily be influenced by that. Maybe we say, well, the authority isn't worthy of my respect. I have this question for you. Was Saul worthy of David's respect? He wasn't. David had helped him out in a huge way, and various times actually at this point. He had proven himself of a much higher integrity level than Saul. Saul wasn't worthy of respect, but the level of respect we show must be according to the level of authority of our superior and not according to what we decide is their worthiness. That's respect. The level of respect we show must be according to the level of authority of our superior, not according to what we decide is their worthiness. David had that clear in his mind. We are not given the option to decide if an authority is due our respect or not. We're simply asked to respect. David's character demanded him to show respect even to the unworthy and even to the extent that he felt guilty wronging his superior to make a point. In the time of respect, David proved himself to be respectful. Number four, the time of discouragement. Move on back to 1 Samuel chapter 30. The time of discouragement. This little story happened at a time when David and his men had moved over to the land of the Philistines to live there because they knew Saul wouldn't come after them there. And in that, he kind of became friends with Achish, king of Gath. And when it was time for the Philistines to go fight a war, David said, "We'll go with you." The only problem was the war was against Israel. And the Philistines said, "Now, wait a minute, this is not going to work. When David and his men get out there and start fighting their own people, they're going to turn against us. So you just go back home. You just go back home. That's okay. We don't need you." So they turned around. I don't know how long it took them, but they got back to the city where they were living with their families. And when they got there, another army had come in, stolen their wives and children and all their possessions, and burnt the city. I'd like to read verses 1 to 6. "And it came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded," that Ziklag was where they lived, "that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burnt it with fire. Had taken the women captives that were therein, they slew not any great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burnt with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captives. Then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives were taken captives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God." Now, how bad was this? It was that bad that we have 600 men crying until they couldn't cry anymore. I have no idea what that sounded like or how long it took. But they cried till they couldn't cry anymore. That's how frustrated and discouraged and defeated they were. And they looked for someone to take this grief and this bitterness out on, and they looked at David and said, "Why don't we get rid of him? This isn't going well." Well, David too had lost his family and his possessions and all his resources. He had everything to be sad about that they did. Plus, now they were turning against him. Well, you know, like everyone that's in dire straits has a choice to make. And David had that choice to make too. It was either turn away from God, quit, throw in the towel, let bitterness take over. But we're told that David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And I came up with this question. Why is it that in times of testing and frustration and disappointment and discouragement, we want to turn against God? Why is that the easiest thing to do? I don't know if it's just human nature. If it's because we thought we had this little deal going with God where he's going to make us a nice life. But somehow that seems to be our natural tendency. Even when he tells us, "I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." Well, again, we have to look beyond the obvious. We have to look beyond the obvious. David did. Instead of turning away from God, he turned to God and said, "What do you want me to do?" And God said, "Go after them. You're going to get everything back." And that's exactly what happened. So I ask us this morning, in our times of frustration and discouragement, are we going to allow them times to make us better or bitter? Our choice will determine that. Point number five is the time of the temptation of lust. Let's move on to 2 Samuel chapter 11. The time of the temptation of lust. Turn to in 2 Samuel 11. I'd like to read verses 1 to 4. "And it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Raba, but David tarried still at Jerusalem. And it came to pass in an eventide that David arose from his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman, and one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the daughter of Uriah the Hittite?" And David sent messengers and took her. She came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her own house. We'll stop right there. Now, here David fell into the sin of adultery. We might ask, what went wrong here? How did this good man, this man that was serious about his relationship with God, how did this happen? And I don't know if I even can answer all those questions, but as I looked at the story, this short story, I came up with a few ideas. Number one, he stayed home from the battle. It tells us here that this time of the year, the kings would go forth to battle. It was normal for the king to go along. It was his army. It was his battle. He went along out. David stayed home. Now, by now, David probably fully trusted Joab, and he said, he can handle it. I don't need to go along. There's no reason for me to go along. Joab knows what I would have done. He knows how I would do it. He can handle this. They can do it without me. Well, I don't think it's a Bible verse. I didn't check, but there's an old saying that goes like this. Idleness is the devil's workshop. And might it be that because David had nothing to do, this happened? I believe that when we can find nothing to do, the devil will supply something. Secondly, David chose not to resist the devil, as we're told to do. Instead, he was drawn away of his own lusts and enticed. And I want to caution us, because I doubt any of us think we're a better person than David was, a man of more integrity or higher character. And so we need to be honest with ourselves, because we're told, "Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest we fall." We need to be on guard. And as I thought about the coming of spring here this week, it doesn't feel too warm today. But it's going to get warmer, and people are going to be undressing. What are we going to be looking at? I had to think about those Amish horses I go past on the road, and the horses have blinders on. And the Amishman puts that on his horse so that the horse doesn't see some things he shouldn't see. You and I have to install our own blinders. If not, we're opening ourselves up to falling, just like David. David didn't put the blinders on. He didn't make that choice, and he fell. Let's be diligent. Let's be vigilant in our times of temptation for lust. Number six, the time of humility. A couple chapters back, 2 Samuel 16. I'd like to read verses 5 to 13. 16, verse 5. And when King David came to Bahurim, there, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gariah. He came forth and cursed still as he came. Now, I might interject here that this was when Absalom took over the throne, trying to take the kingship from his father. And David fled the city. And as he was fleeing, this is what happened. And this Shimei cast stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people, and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. The Lord hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And the Lord hath delivered the kingdom into thy hand, into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man. Then said Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, unto the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, and I pray thee, I'll take off his head. Then the king said, what have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord hath said unto him, curse David. Who shall then say, wherefore hast thou done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son, which came forth out of my bowels, seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjamite do it? Let him alone, and let him curse, for the Lord hath bidden him. It may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction, and that the Lord will requite me good for this cursing this day. And as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hillside over against him, and cursed as he went, and threw stones at him, and cast dust. You know, one way to really know if we're humble or not is to check what our reaction is when we're mistreated. What comes out of us? What goes through our minds when we're mistreated? If you or I had been King David, King of Israel, who had killed many people in his zealousness for God, what would have been our reply? Go ahead, take him out. This isn't fit. This isn't right. Take him out. Well, we might not think that. But have you ever kind of wished that somebody would face some hard times or a struggle because of what they did to you? It's kind of the same thing, isn't it? True humility thinks, I wonder what God wants me to learn through this. It's easy for us to completely miss what God wants us to learn when we're mistreated and to only think of vengeance on the other person. Romans 12:19, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto the wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Yet humility refuses to see through the eyes of revenge, but rather lets the revenge up to God and expects spiritual growth for himself through that experience. That's what humility does. And so an opportunity for revenge is turned into an opportunity to grow in humility. Point number 7, the time of pride. 2 Samuel 24. Excuse me. Let's turn to 2 Samuel 24. I'd like to read verses 1 to 10. And again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go, number Israel and Judah. For the king said to Joab, the captain of the host, which was with him, go now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, and number ye the people, that I may know the number of the people. And Joab said unto the king, now the Lord thy God add unto the people, how many soever they be, an hundredfold, and that the eyes of my lord the king may see it. But why doth my lord the king delight in this thing? Notwithstanding, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the host, and Joab and the captains of the host went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. And they passed over Jordan and pitched in Aroer on the right side of the city that lieth in the midst of the river of Gad, and toward Jazer. And they came to Gilead, to the land of Timhadi. And they came to Danjanin and about Zidon, and came to the stronghold of Tyre, and to all the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites, and they went out to the south of Judah, even to Beersheba. So when they had gone through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave up the sum of the number of the people unto the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men that drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men. And David's heart smote him after that he had numbered the people. And David said unto the Lord, I have sinned greatly in that I have done, and now I beseech thee, O my Lord, take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. Now this is kind of a unique happening here, because we're not told why God was angry with his people. But I did find one commentator that I thought made a little sense out of it. Supposedly this happened near the end of David's life. And he had fought lots of wars with the neighboring countries and subdued all of them, I'm going to say, most if not all. And so they were at a time of peace. It was time to sit back and enjoy life. Israel was becoming fat and lazy. And God looked down and didn't like what he saw. The ambition to fight for the king, to fight for God, wasn't there. It was an attitude of lackadaisicalness. Just, hey, whatever. We don't have to get ready for the next battle because there ain't going to be any more. Maybe that's what God saw. And in that time, even the king got wondering, we're not really fighting right now. I wonder how many soldiers I actually have. It'd be kind of nice to know. Wonder if there's any more since we fought the last battle. Doesn't seem like there's any more battles to fight. So why did he want to know? Well, the only reason that we can figure out is for his own ego. He just wanted to know what he was worth. He just wanted to know what his resources were. And Joab said, you don't want to do this, David. You really don't, you shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be thinking this. And guess what? 9 months and some days later, Joab comes back, said, here's the numbers, and bang, David's heart smote him. Then he knew why he did it. He had lots of time to think about it while they were out doing that. But only when they came back and said, this is the number, he said, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I think I've asked this question here before, but I don't remember anybody really answering it. But it's a question I've often thought about. Do we as individuals know when we're proud? Do I know when I'm proud? See, the things I do and the way I think make perfect sense to me. But somehow we can look at others and say, he's kind of proud, isn't he? And David didn't think of it until it was too late. What are some things we can learn about pride? Try to get finished here. First of all, I think we have to be honest. Romans 12:3 says this, for I say through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. We need an honest opinion about ourselves. If we're not careful, we can come up with a lot of things that aren't really quite so about us. But let's look at ourselves honestly and our failures, our needs, the areas where we should improve shouldn't drive us to despair. They should drive us to God and say, help me be what you want me to be. And as for those things that we kind of accomplished or we've accumulated or we've done, well, the next point is thankfulness. 1 Thessalonians 5:18, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. You know, when we are thankful for what we have and what we are and who we are and where we've come to, when we're thankful for that, we're admitting that this really wasn't me. God, it was you. It was your blessing that brought me here, and I thank you. And that should help us to be humble, not proud. One more help when it comes to pride is contentment. Hebrews 13:5, let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have, for he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Now, how do we know if we're content? Maybe that's a little like pride. We can't quite see it. How about when we say no to things we'd like but we don't need, even though we can afford them? How about if there's things we really like but we really can't afford them and we're okay with that? I think those are some things to look at in our lives and say, how do I measure up? Good enough is a good alternative to pride. Scripture also tells us that God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Do you want grace in your life? Be humble. God will be there to bless you. Last of all, point number 8, the time of worship. The time of worship. If you're still here in 2 Samuel 24, after David numbered the people, God said, well, there's going to be a punishment for this, and you can pick which one it is. And David chose 3 days of pestilence, 3 days of plague, 3 days of sickness for his people. And as a result, 70,000 people died. And David was actually, I guess I'll say privileged, to see the angel coming to the city of Jerusalem. And he begged God, please save these people. They didn't do anything wrong. Well, the prophet advised David to build an altar and worship God right on that spot where he saw the angel. 2 Samuel 24, let's read verses 20 to 25. And Araunah looked, that's the man that owned this threshing floor where this happened, and saw the king and his servants coming on toward him. And Araunah went out and bowed himself before the king on his face upon the ground. And Araunah said, wherefore is my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor of thee, to build an altar unto the Lord, that the plague may be stayed from the people. And Araunah said unto David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seemeth good for him. Behold, here are oxen for burnt sacrifice and threshing instruments and other instruments of the oxen for wood. All these things did Araunah as a king give unto the king. And Araunah said unto the king, the Lord thy God accept thee. And the king said unto Araunah, nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar unto the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord was entreated for the land, and the plague was stayed from Israel. So what's the principle of worship that I see here in these verses? Well, the principle is that David did not expect worship to cost him nothing. And he wasn't willing to worship without it costing him something. That was not right to him. He said, sacrifice requires something of me. How can we apply that to our lives? What's the principle that we can see here? Other than a little bit of gas, most of us, it costs very little to come here this morning. But I like to compare worship with entertainment. We live in a day when entertainment can be as close as our phone. And we live among people that they live for entertainment. And maybe we do too much. Some entertainment is very expensive. Some entertainment is practically free. But I believe that we can expect our worship to always cost us more effort than our entertainment. I believe that our worship will cost us more effort than our entertainment. Why? Because worship is a spiritual endeavor and entertainment is a carnal endeavor. It takes an obvious choice to worship. It takes some effort. Because feeding our carnal man always feels easier than feeding our spiritual man. And it's really easy to choose carnal over spiritual, even when we know the spiritual is much better for us and more important. I remember one man who said, church should be hard. That just shook me around a little bit. What was he saying? I think he was saying that worship is not entertainment, and we can expect to have to apply more effort for worship than we do for entertainment. My question is, are we convinced that the extra effort that worship costs us is worth it? David said, and we sang that song this morning, thank you, Brandon, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. It should be a warning sign to us when worship looks like it's taking too much effort. It should be a joy to come and worship. So, just like our old oak tree, and just like King David, the times of our lives will continue to go over us as long as we continue to live.